We're going to find here in chapter 9 that the judgments that are going to come down in Israel that are mentioned in chapter 9 is the death of joy. Joy in their lives is going to be removed. Verses 1 and 2 speak of that, and we'll hit that here in a moment. They're going to be exiled from the land in verses 3 through 6. And we see that they have loss, that they have a loss of spiritual discernment in verses 7 through 9. And then we're going to see one of the judgments is a declining birth rate in verses 10 through 16. We are told in Psalm 27 that children are a blessing from the Lord. And so now that we... it's true. Children are a blessing from the Lord. And so a declining birth rate for the nation of Israel would show God's displeasure with them. And that's verses 10 through 16. And then we see a final casting out in verse 17. And so those five things, the joy is removed, they're exiled from the land, they have loss of spiritual discernment, their declining birth rate, and the casting out is what we're going to go over here tonight. And so the first one, the removal of joy or the death of joy, Hosea 9:1 says, "Do not rejoice, O Israel, with joy like other peoples, for you have played the harlot against your God. You have made love for hire on the threshing floor." So, God threatens here to deprive this degenerate seed of Israel of all their worldly things that they enjoy. And the reason is because of their sin. And because of that, they have forfeited their right to be a joyful people of God's blessing. And so, he tells them the reason why. You've played the harlot against your God, and you have made love for hire in every threshing floor. So, Francis Schaeffer says that during this time, a woman would be out harvesting, and there is a freedom in the midst of the harvest. She takes the gift of money from some man to have sex with him on the corn floor in the midst of the harvesting. And that is what those who had become God's people had become. The wife of the living God is this in her apostasy, is what he says. So just to back up for a moment, because we're going to be hitting on this time and time again tonight as well as through the rest of Hosea. But when the people of Israel would go and worship the gods of Baal, Baal is the thunder god, is the rain god, the god of fertility that brings rain, that brings fruit to the land, okay? And so one of the ways to worship Baal in his many different forms is through the act of sex. And so to have sex in an open field, to have sex before the rains come, during the summer months, during the harvest, to show that this is the way I worship you through the fruitfulness of their loins and having children by having sex acts is also worship to the god of Baal in order to provide the rain and the produce in the field as well as the many flocks in the field and things like that. So Francis Schaeffer is saying right here is that one of the things that they would do during the middle of the harvest is that if a man would come up and offer you money, if you worship Baal like he did, you would have sex right there in the middle of the field. So this is what is going on here. These are the gods of fertility that they worship. And this is what Israel was doing at this time. So verse 2 says, "The threshing floor and the winepress shall not feed them. And the new wine shall fail her." The time is going to come when there's going to be a scarcity in abundance when it comes to food, as it comes to wine. Wine is usually seen as a thing of luxury, so the luxuries are going to go away. And so not only that, but the abundance of food is going to go away as well. And so because of that, the joy will be gone. When you're hungry and there is no wine, guess what? You're going to be very, very hungry and you will have no joy at that time. And then so the joy is going to be gone. And then in verses 3 through 6, you're also going to be exiled from the land that God has promised your forefathers, the land flowing with milk of honey. You're going to be gone from that. The promised land in which you inhabit, you will no longer be there. And so he says in verse 3, "They shall not dwell in the Lord's land, but Ephraim shall return to Egypt and shall eat unclean things in Assyria." When you see Ephraim, as I've mentioned before in this study, Ephraim and Israel are synonymous. Okay, Ephraim is the largest tribe at this point in Israel. So when I say Israel, even though it might say Ephraim, it's the same thing. Okay, And so it says that Ephraim, or Israel, the northern kingdom, is going to return to Egypt and shall eat unclean things in Assyria. God makes it very clear he's going to pull them out of the land. And I want to make this very clear, that God is not breaking his promise to Abraham or to Moses or to David. The land belongs to the Jews, has always belonged to the Jews. From the moment that God brought them into the promised land, that land has always belonged to the Jews. Now, there might be other interlopers in the land in between the time of their faithfulness, but guess what? The land is theirs. It's kind of like you might own a home, but guess what? You move out of the house and then you rent it to someone else. It's still your house, even though somebody else is there. That's exactly what God does with the people of Israel. He says, I'm moving you out. Because understand, in order to stay in the land, totally is your responsibility and your faithfulness. Me getting you the land, me saying the land is yours, that's based on my faithfulness. But you remaining in the land, that is 100% your faithfulness. And if you're not going to remain faithful, then get out. But guess what? The land is yours, but you're not going to be able to partake in the blessing of that land because of your unfaithfulness. And so as he's kicking them out, just understand it's still their land, okay? It's still their land. But Israel had proven herself unworthy of remaining in the land. But Ephraim shall return to Egypt and shall eat unclean things in Assyria. What is it? Are they going to go to Egypt? Or are they going to go to Assyria? Well, when the Assyrians started to come, a lot of them tried to escape to Egypt. Okay, the majority of them did not escape to Egypt, and they were taken captive to Assyria. But either way, make no mistake, no matter where you end up, you're going to eat unclean things, and you're not going to prosper where you go, is what is being mentioned here. When the Assyrians takes you away, you're going to be fed unclean things, things foreign to you, against the dietary laws of the Jews. They're going to eat things that they would never have considered eating before because they're going to be in such dire need and poverty, whether that's moldy bread or eating pork or eating other things that they would not normally eat because they're going to a foreign land and they don't get to dictate what they get to eat and what they don't. And so these are going to be very, very desperate times when they're in Assyria and when they're captured in Egypt. And so verse 4 says, they shall not offer wine offerings to the Lord. Not only are you going to be a captive people, but you're not going to be able to worship the way they used to worship, even though it wasn't done in spirit and truth. There is a pride that Israel had of worshiping God with their offerings and everything else, even though their heart wasn't in it and they worshiped a multiplicity of gods. Their traditions that they grew up with, they're not going to be able to take with them. And so it is telling us right here, they shall not offer wine offerings to the Lord, nor shall their sacrifices be pleasing to him. It shall be like the bread of mourners to them. All who eat it shall be defiled, for the bread shall be for their own life. It shall not come into the house of the Lord. Bread of mourners. Once you are around a dead body, you are unclean. And so you would eat the food that is there in the way of celebrating that person's life or mourning over that person's life, but you're unclean for the next 7 days. He's saying that's the way it's going to be as you are away. You're going to be unclean that entire time. You're going to be unclean, and so you cannot go before the presence of God. And so these wine offerings would cease. These were both the daily and the Sabbath practice offerings. They're connected with the peace offerings as well as the burnt offerings. Hosea is foretelling that all their public sacrifices are going to end completely. And it's because you're going into another land. And so you cannot sacrifice in another land. You can only sacrifice in the land that God has told you to sacrifice in. And so because of that, their offerings will not be received, won't be acceptable to the Lord. And so interesting that a nation that refused to conduct its formal worship in the proper spirit would be not denied this privilege to worship where they are going. Hey, if you don't want to worship me properly, then I'm going to take you to a place that you can't worship me. Basically is what he's saying there. And so Israel is going to be wandering among the nations, going to be exiled from this beloved land. And this is when Hosea poses this question here in verse 5. He says, what will you do in the appointed day and in the day of the feast of the Lord? The feasts were a reason for joy. It spoke about how God was gracious and how good he's been to Israel. They are not going to be able to celebrate that anymore. The word day here is in the singular. So there's many who think this is speaking of a very specific feast. And they believe it speaks of the Feast of Tabernacle, because the word tabernacle means dwelling. And it is a feast that celebrates God dwelling in the midst of his people. And what are you going to do when you're out of the land and you're exiled? And you're now a slave to the Assyrians, or a slave back to being slaves to Egypt. What are you going to do? You're going to know that God is not in the midst of the people. How are you going to celebrate that day? How are you going to celebrate that day? And if anything, it is going to bring them to a reminder of going, the reason we're in these dire straits, the reason we're in the situation we are, is because we did not worship God the way that we were supposed to, and we were not obedient to what it is that he has called us to do. And so because of that, he's no longer in our midst. He's no longer in our midst. So he goes on and says, for indeed they are gone because of destruction. Egypt shall gather them up. Memphis shall bury them. Again, those fleeing the destruction of Assyrians are going to be swallowed up by Egypt. Memphis at this time was the capital of Egypt and also a famous burial place for the Egyptians. Nettles shall possess their valuables of silver. Thorns shall be in their tents. So what this means is that where normally you would your treasures of silver and you yourselves would be in your tents, there are thorns and nettles now in the tents because you're no longer there, because it's all been given over to desolation. And so joy is gone. They're going to be exiled from the land. And they are going to be completely at a loss of spiritual discernment. They're going to have zero spiritual discernment at all. And so it says in verse 7, the days of punishment have come. The days of recompense have come. Israel knows the prophet is a fool. The spiritual man is insane because of the greatness of your iniquity and great enmity. Now, there are those who think that this prophet that's being spoken of here is a false prophet. But the reason why he can't be a false prophet is because he's a spiritual man. And a spiritual man is never called a false prophet. A spiritual man is never, this term spiritual man is never put together with a false prophet. A spiritual man is always going to be a true prophet, okay? So when you know that and you read this now, it says the days of punishment have come. The days of recompense have come. Israel knows. And so this is what Israel has been doing. They're calling the prophet a fool. They call the spiritual man insane. Why? Because of the greatness of their iniquity and their great enmity. And their great enmity. The word fool here means silly. It means unworthy of attention. Just blow that guy off. He's nuts. Not going to listen to a word he has to say. Just unworthy, okay? Unworthy of attention. The word insane means what you think it means, insane or mad, okay? You're crazy. They said these things about Isaiah, Jeremiah, many of the prophets of God, they're mad. You don't know what you're talking about. You're insane. You know who else they said that about? Jesus. Jesus 10:18 says, no one takes it from me, speaking of himself, but I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down. I have power to take it again. The command I receive from my Father. Therefore, there was division among the Jews because of these sayings. And many of them said, he has a demon and is mad. Why do you listen to him? And yet others who had not lost their spiritual discernment said, these are not the words of one who has a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind? These are not words of a madman. This is not words of a demon, okay? This guy's doing nothing but good things. He's healing people. He's bringing us the kingdom of God. How can you say he's mad? A madman cannot do the things that he does. You know who else they called mad? The Apostle Paul. Remember before Governor Festus. It says, now as he had made his defense, Paul, before Festus, Festus said with a loud voice, Paul, you are beside yourself. Much learning is driving you mad. But he said, I'm not mad, most noble Festus, but speak the words of truth and reason. How many of you here have ever witnessed to somebody and they just look at you and you go, you're nuts? How can you believe that? You know, that's just a creation of man, that word. We are much more enlightened today. You know, you're mad. You're crazy. And it says, and because of this, the greatness of your iniquity and great enmity. Enmity means hatred, by the way. Why do the Israelites call the prophets of God fools and insane? Because of their iniquity. I want you to go to Isaiah 59. Isaiah 59, my very first verse. It's one of my favorite verses. The rest of it, not so good for people who don't know God. But verse 1 is very good for people who don't know God. Chapter 59 of Isaiah, verse 1, behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, nor is ear heavy that it cannot hear. Isn't that awesome? You can cry out to God at any time. Say, Lord, help, save. He's there. As an unbeliever, those who want to bow their knee and receive the Lord and ask God to save them, he's not far away. His hand's not too short that he cannot save. And his ear too heavy that it cannot hear. But understand this. In verse 2, your iniquities have separated you from God. And this is Isaiah, and he is speaking to Israel here, okay? And your sins have hidden his face from you. And what's going to happen? He's not going to hear. He's not going to hear. For your hands are defiled with blood, your fingers with iniquity, your lips have spoken lies, your tongues have muttered perversity. No one calls for judgment, nor does any plead for truth. They trust in empty words and speak lies. They conceive evil, bring forth iniquity. They hatch viper's eggs and weave the spider's web. He who eats of their eggs dies, from that which is crushed, a viper breaks out. Their webs will not become garments, nor will they cover themselves with their works. Their works are works of iniquity, sin, and the act of violence in their hands. Their feet run to evil. They make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Wasting and destruction are in their paths. The way of peace they have not known. There is no justice in their ways. They have made themselves crooked paths. Whoever takes that way shall not know peace. You should underline that. You want to go the way of the world? You want to go the crooked way? You will not have peace. And that means peace with God, by the way. That means peace with God. Therefore, justice is far from us, nor does righteousness overtake us. We look for light, but there is darkness. For brightness, but we walk in blackness. We grope for the wall like the blind. We grope as if we had no eyes. We stumble at new day as it is twilight. We are dead men in desolate places. We all growl like bears. Everybody's grumpy. And moan sadly like doves. We look for justice, but there is none. For salvation, but it is far from us because you're looking in the wrong places. For our transgressions are multiplied before you. Our sins testify against us. For our transgressions are with us. As for our iniquities, we know them. I haven't met anyone, okay? And if I do, I know they're lying. That when they come to Christ, if I was to ask them and they were to be honest, said, look, I know you didn't know Jesus before. I get that. But did you think the way that you were walking was righteous? No, I knew. I couldn't put a finger at it. I knew this was wrong, though. Even though nobody told me, I knew before I came to Christ. I knew. And you do know. And he goes on and he says, in transgressing and lying against the Lord and departing from our God, that is the reason they're in the predicament that they are. They have departed from God. Israel has departed from God. That's why everything that we just read previous to that was going on with them, because they first departed from God. But guess what? The Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, nor is his ear heavy that it cannot hear. Cry out to him, but they don't. but they don't. And so he goes on and says, speaking oppression and revolt, conceiving and uttering from the heart words of falsehood, justice is turned back. Righteousness stands afar off. The truth is fallen in the street. Equity cannot enter, so truth fails. And he who departs from evil makes himself prey. The individual, because at this point, the majority of society of Israel, guess what? Gone. They've already made their bed. They already know this is the direction they want to go. They've departed from God. And the individual who turns back to God, he's going to be prey to them. In the long run, it's going to be more of a blessing for that person, but he is going to be swimming against the tide of evil, is what's going to happen to him. And so, going back here to Hosea, because of the greatness of your iniquity and great enmity, it says at the end of verse 7 here. And so they call the prophets of God fools. They call them insane for this reason. Their iniquity, they departed from God, and because of their great enmity, and that's enmity towards God. And the word enmity means hatred. Means hatred. So how did they come to hate God? Well, James tells us in James 4:4, adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is what? Enmity with God. You start falling in love with the world, and it's just a matter of time before you begin to hate God or the things of God, and definitely God's people. That is the downfall. If you fall in love with the world, you'll depart from God. You'll eventually find yourself at enmity with him and his people. And that's the place that they have come. Going over here to verse 8 of Hosea 9. The watchman of Ephraim is with my God, but the prophet is a fowler's snare in all his ways, enmity in the house of his God. The watchman of Ephraim, the watchman was responsible for warning. They were responsible for warning of the approaching enemy. That's what many of the prophets were doing. And it became a snare in many ways. And they wouldn't listen. And to the point where enmity is now in the house of God himself. You read about Israel and how many of the kings actually closed the doors. Manasseh actually closed the doors of the Lord. There was no more worshiping God during Manasseh's reign. And there's another king, I can't remember who it is, did the exact same thing. And so they actually brought enmity to the house. Closing the doors of the temple? What are you saying? I hate God. I do not want to worship God. I want nothing to do with God. And it says in verse 9, they are deeply corrupted as in the days of Gibeah. There was no lower place, lower point in the history of Israel than the days of Gibeah. Why don't we go over here to Judges chapter 19? This is the lowest place in their spiritual history where they almost wiped out a tribe. So, just going to read verse 1 here. And it came to pass in those days that there was no king in Israel. And there was a certain Levite staying in the remote mountains of Ephraim. He took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah, but his concubine played the harlot against him, went away from him to her father's house of Bethlehem in Judah, and was there 4 whole months. And so the husband, or this Levite, goes back to Judah there, goes to Bethlehem, and then speaks to her father and gets his concubine, and it's on his way back that he stops at Gibeah to spend the night. Okay, and so it is here that all of a sudden you read in verse 12, but his master said to him, we will not turn aside here into a city of foreigners. We are not of the children of Israel. We will go on to Gibeah. So he said to his servants, come, let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night in Gibeah or in Ramah. And they passed by and went their way, and the sun went down near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin. And they turned aside there to go into lodge in Gibeah. When he went in and sat down in the open square of the city, for no one would take them into his house to spend the night. Just then an old man came in from his work in the field at evening, who also from the mountains of Ephraim, he was staying in Gibeah. Whereas the men of the place were Benjamites, And when he had raised his eyes, he saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, where are you going and where do you come from? And he said to him, we are passing from Bethlehem in Judah toward the remote mountains of Ephraim. I am from there and I went to Bethlehem in Judah. Now I'm going to the house of the Lord, but there is no one who will take me into his house. Therefore, we have both straw and fodder for our donkey and bread and wine for myself, for your female servant, and for your young man who is with your servant, there is no lack of anything. And the old man said, peace be with you. However, let all your needs be my responsibility. Do not spend the night in the open square. Now, an open square in a village is a place where travelers are supposed to come and live in safety. The townspeople there are responsible for the safety of anyone that comes and lodges there in their town when they go to the open square. This is actually a place that is supposed to be very, very hospitable. And so he knows, okay, nobody, I don't know anyone here. He's not knocking on doors and nobody will take him in. He just doesn't know anyone there. So no one's going to take me in. We might as well just spend the night here in the open square. It's safe in all the other cities. He's assuming it's going to be safe there. But the old man knows the city of Gibeah. He knows how low they have fallen, how much they have plunged in the area of immorality. And he knows not a good idea. And for him to think not a good idea means that it's because something else obviously has happened to people who have spent time in the open square. So he says, no, come stay at my house, okay? Come stay with me. And so in verse 22, it says, as they were enjoying themselves, suddenly certain men of the city, perverted men. The word perverted means twisted, okay? Very twisted. Surrounded the house, beat on the door. They spoke in the master of the house and the old man saying, bring out the man who came to your house that we may know him carnally. That means we want to have sex with that man is what that means. But the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, no, my brethren, I beg you, do not act so wickedly. Seeing this man has come into my house, do not commit this outrage. Look, here's my virgin daughter and this man's concubine. Let me bring them out to you. Let me bring them out now. Humble them and do not do this as you please, but to this man do not do such a vile thing. Now, without getting into detail with this, as much as I appreciate this old guy protecting this man, to offer up his virgin daughter just makes me sick to my stomach. Okay? To again just tell you, he's not all righteous either. All right? He's thinking, well, at least this isn't as bad as doing it to this man. I don't even want to go there right now. So instead, look, he says, but the men would not heed him. So the man took his concubine, brought her out to them, and they knew her and abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. Now, for the rest of the story here, what happens here is that because she was out all night and being abused and everything else, she died. And so the Levite then takes her body, gets home, and then cuts her up into 12 pieces to send out to the different 12 tribes of Israel. And it worked because it shocked everyone. And they rallied together because they have never seen such wickedness in Israel. Now, as they got together, what he explained to them, this is what happened. This is how my concubine died. I did not kill her and cut her up into 12 pieces. She was already dead because of this abuse, but understand what they wanted to do with me. How is it that a tribe could behave so wickedly? And so what they do is they say, send the men out that are responsible for this in Gibeon. And the tribe of Benjamin would not do it, which tells you they are of like-mindedness. And they have fallen to the depths of depravity where they didn't see this as being a sin. And so what happens? Well, they go to war and they almost wiped out the whole tribe of Benjamin. Only 600 of them were left. And so this, in Israel's history, was a very, very low point of morality. And everybody knew the story of Gibeah and the low morality and the depths that they plunged for that. Hosea is saying, we're here now. We're here now. So it's kind of like we're back to the depths of depravity that we were in the days of Gibeah back in Judges chapter 19. That's a pretty big charge to be laid upon them. It's a pretty big charge. And it's telling them that you guys are as low as you've ever been in your history. And he brings up here with Gibeah. And so Hosea is announcing this benchmark of their history was now rivaled by Israel's blatant sins themselves. This moral low ground has now been met once again. And so because of that, we see in verse 10, we're now going to have this declining birth rate. Because you have plunged to the depths of such depravity and such sexual immorality. Well, guess what? What sex is supposed to do between a husband and wife and produce children in order to raise godly offspring that we read in God's word, you're not even going to have kids anymore. And so there's going to be a declining birth rate. And so it says in verse 10, I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. He goes back. This reference is the beginning of Israel's origins. In the midst of this sense of judgment, God himself, his tender heart, is going back to Israel's earliest days of when I first found you and when we first had this covenant together. And he says, I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. It's such a sweet thing. You're in the wilderness, you're in the desert, you've been walking around, and then to come across some grapes is a beautiful thing. As the first fruits of the fig tree in its first season, the very first figs to ripen were always the sweetest. But they went to Baal Peor and separated themselves to that shame. That shame means shameful idol, by the way. And so this should read, but they separated themselves to that shameful idol and they became an abomination like the thing they loved. I want you to go to Numbers chapter 25. Earlier Numbers, we read that the children of Israel moved and camped in the plains of Moab. And so Balak, who is the king there, didn't like Israel being there in his land, and so knows about Balaam and says, you know, you're a prophet of God. I will pay you to stand here upon this plateau and look down upon them and bring a curse upon them because I know whatever you say is going to come true. And so Balaam tries to do it three different times, but God comes to him and says, I'm not going to allow you to curse my people. And so what ends up coming out of his mouth instead are these blessings. And Balak, the king, is upset. Hey, I'm paying you to curse them, not bless them. And then the very last time he says, look, let me take you aside and tell you what these people are going to do to your people. And so we're kind of left there. And then we see here in chapter 25, it says in verse 1, now Israel remained in the acacia grove. And the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. Well, why were they doing that? You say, well, because they're human and that's just human nature. And when beautiful women just come into their campsite and they decide to go off with them. And okay, but do you know whose idea it was? I want you to go to chapter, keep your hand here, go to chapter 31. After they took vengeance on the Midianites, it says here, in verse 8, that they killed the kings of Midian with the rest of those who were killed, Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, Reba, the five kings of Midian, and Balaam, the son of Beor, they also killed with the sword. So this guy that was a prophet of God that tried to bring curses upon him. But look what it says in verse 16. Look, these women caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the incident of Peor, and there's a plague among the congregation of the Lord. We know that even though he could not curse Israel, what we do know is that he ended up going to the king and saying, look, here's a good way to get them to sin. Because here's what I can't do. I can't curse them, but I do know their God, and their God is going to judge them if they begin to worship other gods. And here's how you can get them to worship other gods. Send these women into the camp. Send these women to the camp. And so they do. And so they go off with them. They get introduced to Baal of Peor, the fertility gods of Baal. And this is how we worship our God. And it's through sex and sensuality. And, well, that sounds like fun, you know. And so they do. They start worshiping other gods because of the sex acts that go along with them. And so it says here in chapter 25, now Israel remained in acacia grove, and the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. And they invited the people to the sacrifice of their gods. And the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel was joined to Baal of Peor. And the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people, hang the offenders before the Lord out in the sun, and that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. So Moses said to the judges of Israel, every one of you kill his men who were joined to Baal of Peor. Whatever men went off with these women and began to worship these false gods, kill them. And indeed, one of the children of Israel came and presented to his brethren a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel who were weeping at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Now when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he rose from among the congregation and took a javelin in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent and thrust both of them through the man of Israel and the woman through her body. So what that means is that this Midian woman that presented before the brethren as they're weeping to Lord for forgiveness was obviously walking across the camp into this person's tent. And so when Phinehas saw it, they had obviously began to have sex, and he goes in there and with one javelin goes through both of them. And it says, so the plague was stopped among the children of Israel, and those who died in the plague were 24,000. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, has turned back my wrath from the children of Israel because he was zealous with my zeal among them, so I did not consume the children of Israel in my zeal. He responded the way that God wanted him to respond, with the same zeal he felt. How dare you? And he just ran him through. This is the place where Hosea is saying, you plunged to this depth, not only to the time of Gibeah, but also Baal of Peor. When this happened in our history, this is another area in our history we don't like to bring up, but God's going to bring it up and says, you're not doing anything different than these guys did here. You're not doing anything any different at all. You've separated yourself to that shame of that idol, and they became an abomination like the thing they love. Interesting. They became what they loved. You know, in Psalm 135, verse 15, it says, the idols of the nations are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, they do not speak. Eyes they have, but they do not see. They have ears, but they do not hear. Nor is there any breath in their mouth. Those who make them are like them. You become what you worship. That's who you are. How do you get to that place? I want you to go to Romans chapter 1. I don't know if I've ever gone through the book of the Bible without referring to Romans chapter 1. How do we get to this place? How did they do that? What were they thinking? Go to Romans chapter 1. Verse 18 says, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness, unrighteousness of men. So his judgment is always going to come upon those who are ungodly, those who are unrighteous, who suppress the truth. In order to suppress the truth, you have to have the truth. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. So to the person who says to me, says, look, there are none righteous, no, not one. I go, yeah. So what's the problem? Meaning, well, unless, you know, God is the one that changes your mind, God is the one that saves you before you could be saved. I said, where do you get that? Because none are righteous, no, not one. We're all dead in our trespasses and sin. Oh, okay. But God has placed something in us to know truth. And he wakes that up in us by the creation of the world, as he tells right here. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them. There's something in us, all of us, for God has shown it to them. How? Through the creation of the world. His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. God stirs the heart of every man and woman that has ever lived through his creation. And if he didn't do that, yeah, there's none righteous, no, not one. There's none that would just seek after God. If God did not stir their heart as they looked out at creation, knowing that if there is a creator, if there is a creation, there must be a creator. If there is design, there has to be a designer. It's just common sense. It is reason. And if you don't buy into that, you are suppressing the truth. And you can do that. But if you continue to do that, it says here, because although they knew God, you know God's stir in your heart to know that. Even though they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were they thankful, but instead became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. I'm going to go for the philosophy of this world. I'm going to go and fall in love with the things of this world. I'd rather do what the world says to do. But you're suppressing the truth in order to do that. But if you continue to do that, professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creepy things. And if you want to go that way, it says, and therefore God also gave them up to the uncleanliness in the lusts of their heart to dishonor their bodies among themselves. That's what happened in Gibeah. That's what happened in Baal Peor. I'll give you over to your lust. If you want to continue to suppress the truth, I'm going to let you go and make images and worship four-footed creatures and things like that. I'll let you do that. Because you have exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator who is blessed forever. Amen. I'll let you go that direction if you want, but it's going to be hard. You're going to have to suppress the truth. I am stirring that up in you, but the only reason you don't give your life over to me, the only reason you don't bow the knee is because you suppress the truth. And I'm going to allow for you to do that. It's interesting how I can stir this person's heart. They come to know me. I can stir this person's heart, and they choose not to. I'm doing the same stirring. What's the difference? One chooses to listen to that stirring, and one chooses to suppress it because they like the things of the world of what they see, and they'd rather have that. And if you want that, he'll let you have that. And that's probably the worst judgment you can have from God when he gives you over to your own passions and desires. Because whatever you worship, you're going to become like that person. But if you worship Christ, you'll become like him. In verse 11, it says, as for Ephraim, going back here to Hosea 9, as for Ephraim, their glory shall fly away like a bird. No birth, no pregnancy, no conception. So Ephraim, the actual word Ephraim means fruitfulness. Okay? So that fruitfulness is going to fly away like a bird. And so again, by its name, that pun that is being said here, your name means fruitfulness, but you're going to have anything but fruitfulness. You're not going to have any birth, pregnancy, or conception. Now, knowing what it says in verse 12 and knowing the history of the Jews and things like that, we know it doesn't mean that you're not going to have any, okay? What it means here is that it's speaking figuratively. It just means the number of children, which is a blessing from the Lord, as we said, will be greatly, greatly reduced, is what that means. And just like a bird flying away, so is that fruitfulness that God has given you with children going to be fly away as well. Verse 12, though they bring up their children, yet I will breathe them to the last man. Yes, woe to them when I depart from them. Everyone's going to be saddened when the Lord departs from them. And so appropriately, many of those who tried to find security with all these fertility acts through Baal worship and things like that, actually become sterile and barren. In verse 13, just as they saw Ephraim like Tyre, planted in a pleasant place, so Ephraim will bring out his children to the murderer. God has not yet judged Tyre at this time when this was written. And it was at this time that they were they had great prosperity. Great commercial center was in Tyre. Its prosperity was like a fever that was caught with northern Israel, the northern kingdom. It also became a very commercialized center. And so there was this false security of, because there's prosperity in the land, there's all this trading and all this wealth going on, that the people were okay, that God was okay with them, that it was okay to worship all these other different gods in the land. And so they were deceived by the prosperity. I was talking with Joey last night, and we were with some people, and I just said, you know, prosperity is not an indication of how well you are with the Lord. And so I can't look at the tithes and offerings, people here growing in the Lord and things like that, and saying, well, I must be just fine with the Lord. Because I've known many a pastor that have been in very carnal sin for a long time, and yet you look at their church and it was growing during that whole time. People were still getting saved. And so for me to look at my spiritual health by how well things are here at the church, that's I can't do that. I have to look at my spiritual health with my own personal devotion, who I am with my wife, so my wife can keep me accountable, you know, that the board can keep me accountable personally of how I'm living my life, not by what's going on here and how many people are coming or how much money we have in the bank and what God's doing with the property and things like that. That is not an indication of how I am doing with the Lord. And so we got to be careful with that. Hey, look, I just got a promotion at my job. Look, we're able to buy this. We have 3 cars now instead of 2. Oh, I must be doing fine. Yeah, that little sin that I have going on the side, obviously God doesn't care about that. It must be okay. That's a bad place to be. It's a real bad place to be. And so I pray all the time, Lord, if there's any wickedness, if there's something in my life that you want me to change or whatever, show that to me, because I know you care about that. You're very patient, very loving. But are you telling me to quit that, knock that off, don't be watching that show, whatever it might be? Okay. And so in verse 14, he's like, Hosea's kind of doing a prayer here. Give them, O Lord. And then you see, a lot of your Bibles will have a dash, and it means that the prayer was interrupted. And it's almost like Hosea stopped, and he's thinking about all these wrathful things that are happening, and he throws a little prayer in there, and he says, what will you give? In the midst of judgment, will you give some sort of mercy or grace or something? And this is what he says, give them miscarrying womb and dry breasts. Now, why would he pray that? Why is he asking for that for the Lord? I would submit to you, it's better for them not to have any children or miscarry than to have children only to see them taken away in captivity and abused by the Assyrians. And he's saying, this is just a quick little prayer. It's better for them not to have any children at all than to have children and see them being abused right in front of them. And then in verse 15, all their wickedness in Gilgal, for there I hated them. Because of their evil deeds, I will drive them from my house. I will love them no more. All their princes are rebellious. Gilgal is where a lot of this wickedness is coming from, is from Gilgal. And yet so many blessings happened with God there in Gilgal. Gilgal was the first encampment that the Israelites camped in once they crossed over the Jordan River. It was from there that Joshua made it his headquarters as he went out on these campaigns against these other people groups in order to take over the promised land. In Joshua 5:9, it says, and the Lord said to Joshua, this day I've rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. The word Gilgal means rolled away. He says, this is a place of new beginning. All that reproach that you had in Egypt, I roll that away. This is a place of new beginnings. We are now in the promised land. It's new beginnings. Don't look back. Let's move forward from here. This day I've rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. Therefore, the name of the place is called Gilgal to this day. And so that's why it is called Gilgal there. In Joshua 4:19, now the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they camped in Gilgal, hence the first encampment. Also, They set up stones that they took as a remembrance of God bringing them there, new beginnings, out of the Jordan. We also read in Samuel, 1 Samuel 11:14, that Samuel said to the people, "Come, let us go up to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there." That also was kind of the headquarters for the first king there with Saul. And that was Samuel's idea. So all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. And there they made sacrifice of peace offerings before the Lord. And there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. And I don't know how many years, but many, many years, the Ark of the Covenant was there. The tabernacle was there in Gilgal. So Gilgal has a very special place with God and with his people, and it should have a special place with his people. This is a place of new beginnings. This is where God began to really shine his favor upon us in the promised land. It has nothing but good memories, and you have tainted that with the wickedness that comes out. It's kind of like, I love it when I hear me out on this, because it's going to sound weird to begin with. But I love it when churches, when they begin with the Lord and have this incredible testimony, but then heresy comes into it, and then it dies and begins to die and wither on the vine, and then someone new comes in to bring it back to the place where it should be and when they first started out. I'm not thankful that heresy comes in, but we see so many dead churches that didn't start off that way, but and you should be praying, but Lord, bring a godly man there to lead them back to what it is that they were first called to do, be a light and a witness, and truly believe your word above the traditions of men. But I would submit to you that most of the time when churches start to go down that row, it's just a matter of time before they die and they become some religious center for some other false religion. And so in verse 16, it says, Ephraim is stricken. Their root is dried up. They shall bear no fruit. Yes, they were to bear children. Were they to bear children, I would kill the darlings of their womb. Withering root, no hope for the future, ironically, because of widespread sterility and infant mortality. Ephraim, once again, a symbol that was supposed to be a fruitfulness, is going to be compared to being unfruitful, a withering plant. And then they are cast out, the fifth thing here in verse 17. My God will cast them away because they did not obey me. And they shall be wanderers among the nations. Exiled. And that's what happens. You don't obey the Lord. He's very patient. It took hundreds of years before he finally, okay, judgment is coming, judgment is coming. Sending one prophet after another. Please turn. But they don't. And so judgment happens.